listening to discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. And I'm now here with someone who was first on Millennial 8 years ago in 2016. I knew him then as Eric, but he is, I think you already had changed your channel name to Arvol by then. But anyway, Arvol, welcome back to Millennial. Please introduce yourself to people who might not be familiar with you.
Sure, yeah. Good to speak with you again. When I first went on YouTube, I went by my actual name because I just talked about philosophy, and then I got red-pilled by my comment section, and then I started to get concerned, so I changed the public-facing name. But yeah, no, it's been a while. Different era back in 2016. A lot has happened. In some respects, you know, things are a bit darker. I think people don't believe in the possibility of top-down political change as much as they used to. Of course, I was always pessimistic about that possibility. 8 years ago, when I was last on here, I was talking about how my main goal was establishing a white physical community. And now we actually have gotten to that point. In some ways, I've just kind of stuck with it and continued arguing for it. In other ways, I got really lucky and met a high quality group of people with the right expertise. And it just came together all at once last year. So yeah, there were like 25 of us approximately living here on 150 acres in Arkansas. We found a legal framework that allows us to do this. You know, people often talk about how under the Fair Housing Act and other, you know, American equity legislation, we can't do this sort of thing. But that's not strictly true. If you do your research, there are a few options. So that's been the biggest progress over the last 8 years. Other than that, I've continued talking about philosophy. Philosophy has always been my kind of central passion. I've gotten a lot more into classical philosophy and Platonism. I had already read Plato and sometimes talked about Plato and Aristotle even back then, but like the last 5 years, I've really dove into it. And now I do courses on Thinkific, and also I do reading groups through Patreon as well. So we read the Neoplatonists, Pythagorean texts, Aristotle, Greek math. And so, yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing. An ambition I still have is to start a classical philosophy school in person for our circles. The community is a big step towards that because now there's a logical place where that could actually happen. We can get into that, as we move forward here, I guess.
Certainly. Let's start with your, why you thought 8 years ago and still think now that there is a need for a white community. This might seem like a very obvious and ridiculous question to ask, but I want to hear it in your terms.
Right. Well, I've always been a numbers guy. And when I was first red-pilled by my comment section, it was simply because of the demographic change, because of the differential birth rates between Hispanics and other minorities and whites, and the continual rates of immigration. I also trust the numbers when it comes to who actually can meaningfully influence government. And it's always special interests. It's always those with wealth. So it's big corporations. And of course, big corporations have a vested interest in having abundant, cheap labor, high-skilled labor. So the immigration was not going to go down, by my understanding of politics, and the birth rate situation didn't seem to be improving. So with that being the case, it seemed pretty obvious to me that the only way to secure homogeneous, safe communities for my children, and I now have four children. I had, I think one, one was on the way when I was last on Millennial. But yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great.
Yeah. So, yep. I figured that the only way to protect a future for my children was to create a community like this myself. And I've tried it various times, actually. Since then, I've bounced around a little bit. eventually landing here in the Ozarks, which is a great part of the country. There are a lot of rednecks. It has its pros and cons. It's beautiful. It is pretty temperate in the winter, not harsh winter. So it's easy to, you know, deal with the snow and all that kind of stuff. In the summer, it gets pretty hot. But a lot of off-grid people, preppers, choose the Ozarks as their preferred location. I liked it for that reason. Also, just culturally, you know, I don't have to persuade people around here about the main issues that we talk about online. Everybody here just knows it, with the exception of the influence of, you know, Israel in our politics. Many people, especially Protestants, evangelicals, are all in on Israel's our greatest ally, etc. But when it comes to racial relations, it's still just part of the general culture here. And I've met a lot of, you know, great people in person, locally. And of course, we're constantly meeting new people online who are hearing about the project.
Great. This sounds great. That sounds very interesting. The first thing I should ask is the location of your community, the Return of the Land community, is the location of it known? Or is that something that is secret?
You could find out where exactly we are if you wanted to. It's known that it's northeast Arkansas. So we're out in a rural area off a dirt road. The town that we're in is under 1,000 people, which is good because I think one day we will end up outnumbering the local townspeople and we can just kind of take over the government. So,
all right, good. I just wanted to know that in case there's security concerns. Have you had any trouble like that? Like Antifa showing up, anything like that?
No, nothing. You know, I think ultimately we're not going to have as much pushback as activist organizations because it's a bad look to target a group of people that are explicitly just trying to go their own way and do their own thing. Our internal policies prohibit us from conducting activism on behalf of our organization. Return to the Land doesn't do activism. So if they want to write hit pieces on us, if they want to come out here and harass us, it just doesn't look good because we're minding our own business and here they are. Then it's just really clear as day that white people are not allowed simply to exist on their own. You know, in other cases, they can make pretenses that you're, you know, harassing minorities if you take it out into the public square, or that sort of thing. But we're literally just minding our own business. So I think it's not a good look if they do come after us.
Yeah. I hope that continues. And I think, as you say, you've got a good solid basis there. So, okay, how did it, because people will be wondering if they wanted to start something similar to themselves. And obviously this is specific in your case to the United States and perhaps specific to Arkansas. Maybe this wouldn't be feasible elsewhere. I don't know. How did it start? How did you get 150 acres? Because that is quite a lot of land, obviously.
Right. Yeah. To a Brit, it must seem like a lot of land. Of course, we have abundant cheap land here, so it's not as expensive as you might imagine. But we just had the investors come together up front. How this came together. So I already had in mind to start a school. I bought personally 13 acres with a house about 45 minutes from here. And people came down to help me build some facilities, actually a restroom facility for the school that I intended on running out of that location. It would be a classical philosophy school, primarily Plato and Aristotle. So a group of about a dozen guys came down. We worked on this building together and kind of bonded. And some of the guys who were in from out of state decided they really liked the area. They were interested in buying land here. And then the ball just got rolling. And there were about a dozen of us that went in on this land. So, and now the number of people has expanded. So some of the people who bought in up front have sold off some of their shares. I can explain the structure, you know, if people do want to replicate this sort of thing, we're all for that. But also you do have to be very careful because the law is complex about this. So the way to do this legally is to first establish a private member association. Various groups use these because they actually have more legal rights than many other forms of association, even religious associations. Like even as recently as 2 years ago, I always thought that we would simply have to found our own religion that in its tenets, in its religious tenets, stipulated that the value of racial identity. But even then you couldn't explicitly like discriminate on the basis of race. But actually, religious organizations have been sued in the past for racial discrimination, and they are not exempt from that sort of thing. But when you look at the Fair Housing Act, the main reason it's hard to form white communities is this issue prohibiting restrictive covenants. So in the past, to maintain a white neighborhood or an Italian neighborhood, you could have it written into your contract that when you sold the house, you would not sell it to someone outside of this particular ethnic group. That was outlawed in the 1960s when the Fair Housing Act was passed. But in that legislation, it makes exceptions for private associations that are ethnic in character, or basically whatever their character is. Private associations are allowed to manage their own real estate for the use of their own members. So this is one parcel of land, the approximately 150 acres out here, and we manage that.
I've got an illustration of that just so that people can understand this kind of scale involved. So there it is. Apparently, that's about 150 acres.
Yeah, that looks about right. So we have an LLC that we formed to be the legal entity that owns the actual land. And then which person has rights to which part of the land. So basically what the informal lots are, and also other policies as far as like water drainage, road access, right of way for electrical, and just all the stuff that an HOA or any like suburban development company would have to deal with. All of that is handled internally in our LLC documents. So again, there's two levels. The PMA is the legal entity. It's technically not even incorporated as a legal entity, but you do have to do certain things to be recognized as a private association. So we met those criteria. One of those things is that we charge a fee to become a member. It's $25. There's no annual recurring fee after that. And we have about 200 members now. So a lot of people, you know, have expressed interest and have gone through the vetting process and have joined. So the PMA is the entity that is a European ancestry group. And also you can't just have it be about racial or ethnic identity. It has to also have cultural and other components. So we stipulate some stuff about general virtue, you know, nothing really that specific, just sort of the baseline, I think, that you would want when you're trying to establish a neighborhood of people that you're actually going to live around. Also our LLC documents, like how we organize the land here, it is relatively laissez-faire. We have some collectivist elements, like we're building a community center. We already have common meals at least once a week and other events like that. I host some philosophy groups here. We have a town hall every week. But legally speaking, it is kind of a hands-off approach, which I prefer personally. And yeah, so the PMA is a nationwide association. There's actually a couple members from Europe. We have an Irish person. There are a couple people from Croatia who joined a while ago. I would like to see one day this sort of approach to intentional community spread to Europe. I'm obviously not an expert in the legal environment in Europe, so I wouldn't even begin to, you know, talk on it. But yeah, it's a national association. We're focusing here in the Ozarks because things are a lot more hands-off in the local government here. So we don't have zoning restrictions whatsoever. There's no zoning at all. So it's not just residential or agricultural or commercial. It's just open use. So whatever you want to do with your land out here, you can do it. And we don't restrict much further than that, other than because of the nature of our group, we don't allow public-facing businesses where customers from the local area could come onto the land on a regular basis. But we do allow manufacturing businesses where you're mailing out components and selling them online and that sort of thing. Also, we have no building codes locally. The only real building codes that technically we would be held to are the national building codes, but there's no enforcement agency that would actually come out and check on what we're doing. So, of course, we try to build up to best standards as much as possible. And we have one guy with us, Peter Seary. He was the main architect of this legal framework. He was the one who came up with the idea of the PMA and LLC combination, or perhaps he heard about it on some forum and then developed it from there. He's also our main contractor. So he got licensed as a contractor and he does a lot of the construction work. There are several cabins. There's one large kind of starter home, large relative to what we've already built. It's not like a mansion or anything, but it is large enough for a small family to get started. And we're trying to, you know, make it affordable for white families to come down and join. But yeah, the Ozarks is a great place because of the cost. Like, we bought this land at $1,500 US dollars per acre. That's pretty hard to find today. Generally, even in this area today, you don't find much under 2,000 an acre, or more typically 3,000 an acre. In other parts of the country, though, 10,000 an acre is the standard. Like in the Pacific Northwest, you're not going to find anything really for under 10, unless you're way out in some like semi-arid area in, say, Eastern Washington. But yeah, it's the right place. It's affordable. It's easy to actually develop here. There are still a lot of details that you do have to attend to. So if you're going to try to build something like this, you really have to research the laws around septic systems, wells, like how many households are allowed to share a well. And if you have shared water, what are your requirements for either reporting the water standards to local authorities? It's like, it's not just the Wild West out here. It's more that way than most parts of the country. So it makes it easy to get started. And we've learned a lot just in the process of doing this. But for that reason, we don't really encourage people to go out and try to replicate the whole model on their own, because our PMA is very, like I said, hands-off. The standards are pretty minimal. Like, are you white? Do you practice a traditional European religion? So either paganism or Christianity. Do you want to be virtuous? You're not a habitual drug user and things like that. So for that reason, then, we just encourage people, join the PMA and we can affiliate you in with your own LLC, where your group will own your own land, but our PMA will be there to be the legal entity that does the initial kind of discriminating, and then that manages all of those kind of contractual aspects, because we've learned through experience. And also, we had the initial kind of research up front, mostly that Peter did, but yeah.
All right. Well, it's so interesting. And I've got quite a few questions here that occurred to me while you were speaking there. I wasn't sure about whether to ask about the land costs. It seems quite an indelicate question, but you volunteered that information. So, because that obviously is a key thing. A lot of people will be interested in what kind of financial outlay was necessary in order to set this up, in order to get to where you are. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously a matter of curiosity for me, but I think it's very important to some other people. Similar to that, do you have any idea how much the various legal work cost in order to set this up? How much did it all add up to?
Well, actually, starting the PMA was virtually costless. I mean, we had to use some Jotform online programs that I think Peter pays a subscription for, but it's very minimal. I mean, you could do it for under $100. Also, starting an LLC is very inexpensive, only a couple $100, but then there will be some kind of minimal fee on an annual basis. And then the reporting requirements for tax purposes are more complex than if you were just doing this as an individual. So yeah, that's kind of why I say, like, joining RPMA, where we've worked through these hurdles and we have the contracts written up and ready to be modified to particular circumstances, that's what I would recommend. If you want to get into it, though, yeah, start researching what does it take to have a legally recognized private association. And writing the contract for our LLC itself, it has to be something that's legally enforceable and well written. We are now consulting lawyers on it. A handful of lawyers have looked at it on a volunteer basis, and now we're starting to hire specialized lawyers to make sure that if one day we are sued, which is not outside of the realm of possibility, we'll be in as good of a position as possible. And I think it's also important that we are, I think we're the only group like this that's doing it publicly. There are other projects that I'm privately aware of in the US that are doing similar things, but we're intentionally doing it in a way that's just out in the open where our guys are aware of it so that more people can find us and join us and we can scale. The other reason though is that we want to make sure that when the first white intentional communities are targeted legally, the ones that are attacked have their legal case as firm as possible because of the way that precedent works. So if someone did this and did not examine how they were writing their contracts and didn't carefully attend to all the existing case law and conform themselves with it, then when they were sued, they might lose their case because of those technicalities. And now that establishes this precedent where the next person, the next similar institution that sued, they're going to have a harder time winning. So we want to make sure that when there are challenges, the person who is out there visibly in front has done all of their homework and has paid expensive lawyers and, you know,
I'm totally on the same page about this, and I love your thinking that they are going to, because lawfare is the way. I mean, look what happened to VDare, for example. Completely unnecessary thing, but they did it. They used these legalities in order to shut down that organization, not because of they cared about the legalities, but because they wanted that organization shut down. And similar things. I mean, lawfare is the way that they do a lot of this. So it is likely, if not your community, then it is likely that similar communities will be targeted, not because anyone cares about the legalities, but because people don't want communities like this to exist. So I love that you're planning for that in advance. I think that's very sensible. That's great. All right. Here's another question. Do you have any, because people will wonder about this kind of thing with, we're all accustomed to normie world and the mainstream. And we know that the police and the courts and lawyers and so on will handle, there's a system in place to handle various things that come up. You have a community of 25 people. Do you have any system set up to handle disputes between those people? Or at this point, is the community too small to justify such a thing?
We do have processes for dispute resolution written into our LLC bylaws. So typically the board, so we have a board of four members who manage the legal aspects of the LLC, and we will hear out the complaint and advise. There's not a lot of teeth behind what we can actually do ourselves. Luckily, it's a really high quality group of people that have showed up. And so we're not having those conflicts. There was one issue where a road was put in, not where we initially thought it was going to be put in. And then this ended up kind of cutting up someone's lot in a way that they didn't want. And then we just got everyone involved together and found a way to redraw the lines and shift some ownership around where everyone was happy. So as we grow, we'll have to basically reproduce, you know, the English common law system in some capacity and start doing it for ourselves, but we're not quite there yet.
So much is a matter of goodwill, isn't it? Because otherwise people can create a problem if they want to. Are you aiming for self-sufficiency in terms of growing food?
I mean, we would certainly like to get to that point. A couple of us have already started gardens. There are sheep here, chickens. I have goats. They're still at my other property that it's now under contract. So hopefully within the next couple weeks it sells and I can move everything down here and also afford to, you know, develop my own homestead. I definitely believe in self-sufficiency. I've gardened on and off for the last 8 years. The soil quality is not in the Ozarks what it is like in a state like New York or Iowa or Illinois or something. But there are all sorts, like I like going on YouTube and learning different techniques, like, you know, Hugel culture, however you pronounce it, or just permaculture methods. There are several people in the group that are interested in permaculture. We have events twice a year, generally October and April. That's the pattern so far. And we've had somebody give an extensive talk on permaculture methods at each of those. One person is even like a, I guess, licensed advisor on permaculture methods. So we'll probably have him come out at the end of winter here, beginning of spring, to just get us on the right foot. But I'm also a big believer in livestock. I love my goats. I love having the animals around. I love my children interacting with them. So yeah, we're kind of like geared towards agriculture as a whole. Our lot size is 3 acres. So we could have tried to do this jamming many more lots together, you know, having half acre, typical suburban lot sizes to have many more people. All the lots are sold also. So like 25 people are here full time, but all of the parcels of land are actually spoken for. I don't know the exact number of members, but it's over 50. And now we're about to begin the process of putting in offers on the next piece of property, which will probably be the adjacent property to us. So, and with that, we might go a little bit smaller on the lot size, maybe 1 acre potentially. And the main restrictions on how small you can go, again, pertain to septic system regulations, what you can feasibly do with wells. Things have to be set back a certain distance from wells, from property lines, and things of that nature. So it's just contingent on soil quality, for how many systems you can put in, available water, and all that sort of thing. But yeah, we'd like to move from a more agricultural base. This is my vision, eventually moving up to the point where we have apartment buildings outside of urban areas, where we have co-ops that are all focused on the same kind of industry, you know, manufacturing components, CNC, fabrication, that sort of thing.
All right. Fascinating. I love the idea. I really get a thrill from this idea of a community that is self-sufficient to at least to a great extent, and that is just able to survive on its own, independent. But of course, I understand that that's not sort of baked into, I mean, it doesn't require that. It's just, it would be good if that were the case as well. So do you extend, you said you intend to expand beyond the 150 acres. Have you thought about an ultimate sort of state for this community? Do you think it would be, I mean, how big do you see it getting in terms of area and population?
Well, I think at first, in the next 2 years, we're going to focus, at least those of us here present, we're going to focus all nearby in Northeast Arkansas and kind of gradually spread from there. I would like to see in the next 2 years, at least 3 different active sites with multiple families there full time. And I think that is achievable. But in the next 5 years, like by the end of these next 5 years, by 2030, I guess, I would like to see affiliate chapters, different communities in at least 10 different states. And I think that's achievable. Of course, like not all states would be amenable to this sort of thing, because you got to think back to the legal side. And if you're sued in the state of Illinois, if you're sued in the state of New York, the judge that you'll eventually be sitting in front of probably is not going to be sympathetic. Whereas if you go to trial in Arkansas, you have a pretty good shot, I think. So, but I think it is achievable by the end of the next 5 years that we could have at least 10 different sites and 10 different, you know, locations around the country. There are really hubs, though, where people are seriously interested in doing this. So the Pacific Northwest, Idaho, people talk about all the time. Eastern Tennessee, Northern Georgia, that's one hub. Part of North Carolina out there as well is popular. West Virginia, So I think at least those four sites, including where we are, and it's also just contingent on who is available, who maybe already has land that they would like to roll into this sort of thing. And we haven't explored that option too much yet, but like many of the people that we speak with already have, you know, more than 100 acres themselves. I've gotten calls from people wanting to join the PMA because they're hoping to get people out on their land. Now, if you have land of your own, there is the option of converting that ownership into an LLC where you become then a partial owner of it. You have bylaws that spell out what you have as your own homestead. So your home site and everything around it would always be yours. But then you could then allow other people to have a vested interest in your land so that they're not just coming down and developing it for free. So like Owen Benjamin, you know, Bertaria, he has his community in Missouri, I believe. And it's all just his land. So people go there and they build, but ultimately, like legally speaking, they're just building stuff for him for free, which is not, you know, I think an ethical arrangement. It could be exploited. So yeah, there are options like that and just many other interesting options of how to collectively own property that we're just beginning to get into.
Right. You said that people get accepted if they are practicing a traditional European religion, either Christianity or paganism. Has that, and I guess it's early days yet, I realize that's only 25 people, but has that caused any tensions or conflicts, the coexistence of pagans and Christians?
There are arguments in our Telegram server, but I don't think anything has gotten really that heated. Most of the people who are fundamentalist in their particular branch, really, this is just me speaking for my own opinion, not on behalf of like our policies with Return to the Land, but typically like really fundamentalist people have problems socially adjusting. You know, like they aren't necessarily the most well-grounded in their tradition. The real zealous people who are going to be hardliners are often the people who aren't going to last even in their religious faith. You know, I think that's, be sincere in your beliefs, but if you can't be open-minded enough to cooperate with other like decent people just because of doctrinal differences, you're probably not a good neighbor anyway. No, it hasn't really been an issue, and we are attracting more like moderate pagans, moderate Christians, no real fundamentalists.
Yeah. See, I'm sure you'll agree with me. I've said this for quite a while now, based on my own experience in the movement, that any project, I mean, you've got the various legal documents written down, the bylaws, but any project really depends on, it hinges on the types of people who are involved in it, because otherwise they will find, if you've got some maladjusted or misfit or whatever, they will find a way around all of your rules, whatever you've put in, they'll find a way to mess things up, because there are people who for whatever reason are sort of bound, that they enjoy conflict. These are the last people you want involved in almost any project. I mean, they're useful to have on the outside as a sort of defensive shield against the outside world, the sort of sociopathic types who enjoy conflict. They're good at that, but the problem is when they turn their attentions inwards to the project itself and begin falling out with their own allies and colleagues. I'm guessing that you would echo all of that. Do you have any thoughts of your own about this? Because it just, that a project depends on the people who are in it.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely. So we put a lot of forethought into what happens when it turns out that you do have one of these problematic individuals. Already we have admitted to the PMA a couple members that once they came out to the land, because there's multiple processes of vetting, joining the PMA is easier than actually buying into the LLC and becoming an owner. Because at that point, once somebody is a co-owner of a piece of land with you, just kicking them out becomes a lot more complicated. So, but it's happened where people come down who we have accepted into the PMA, we actually meet them in person and realize, okay, this is not going to work. And luckily, we're small enough still, and I think the section of the dissident right that we are speaking to and that we're networked with, we're just getting lucky with the kinds of people that we're interacting with, and things have been going very well. But yeah, quality of the people is everything. We've probably like bumped up the IQ of our town by a standard deviation. That's my estimate. But yeah, people are interested in all sorts of different, you know, philosophical ideas, ancient history. You know, Ashologos was one of the big inspirations in getting this started. Our name comes from a video that he put out, A Call to Return to the Land. That's where Return to the Land comes from. And we all like his videos. He might come down here one day, and I'd love to collaborate with him on ancient history documentaries. But because we have that kind of intellectual side where there are a lot of people interested in Platonism and the stuff that I talk about, there are a lot of people interested in ancient history. There are people who are business owners and, you know, technically skilled, a lot of programmers. And so because you have to be kind of high IQ, conscientious, to get into all those things, it ends up being a really quality group of people.
That's interesting. So it's a kind of self-selecting group in a way. Good. That's terrific. Is there anything else that you'd want to say about this before we move on to the more general issue? Is there anything you'd want people to know about your community and this project? Because I think it sounds very promising, and I want to give you a chance to really promote it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, we'd like to promote the idea of white intentional communities more broadly as well. So we're hosting a conference February 9th. That's Sunday, February 9th, the day of the Super Bowl, which I didn't realize when I scheduled it. But I don't think that's going to detract too much from the potential attendees. Some people that you've already spoken with on Millennial have promised that they would speak there. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, we're going to have lawyers present at this conference. It'll be an online conference and you can attend anonymously. The website is live and ready to go, but there's just a little bit more, you know, fine tuning and testing that I want to do before I give out the URL for that. But if you watch my social media, watch my X account, I will announce it in the coming days. Tickets will be $30 so that we can pay lawyers to be there. And I would like it to be a brainstorming session where I know of all of these projects that are going on doing similar things. I want them to attend and share what their intentions are, what their thoughts are on the legal framework, how they're going about what they're doing. And that way we have a group of like experienced people who have done this and lawyers ready to make this more than just, you know, a session for exchanging the same kinds of ideas that all of us already believe, instead of preaching to the choir, we'll actually productively brainstorm and have tangible next steps that we can move forward with. And of course, through that conference, like I'll promote our organization, but I'm also open-minded to working with other organizations. So I'll announce, I haven't announced publicly, but like I myself personally recently joined Patriot Front. Or I shouldn't say that because they didn't officially accept me, but I've begun the process to join them because I think all of these organizations need to be working together. You know, I respect Thomas Rousseau, his integrity, what he's done for the young men who follow him. You know, I'm getting a little bit old to be out there on the streets marching myself, but I do want our members to be cross-pollinating, and the same with any of these groups. You know, I think there has to be more good faith, willingness to just meet and talk about our common interests and how we can move forward. You know, there are a lot of things that stand in the way of that. Sometimes it's just like, we're not even aware of each other. That was shocking to me as I was getting calls from, you know, hundreds of people looking to apply to the PMA. I would ask them like, okay, how did you find out about us? Or how did you get into these ideas? And I was hearing about podcasts and creators that I was totally unaware of, and sometimes people with big followings, but it's a good sign really, because there are so many of us out there that you can't even keep track. You know, that's one of the reasons Millennial is such a great thing, because you find all of these creators and, you know, help bring us together. So
well, I appreciate that you do that. Thank you. And I hope so. That's certainly one of the intentions. It's why I have a lot of new people on each year. And I sort of, I think I first did that deliberately two or three years ago. And each year I've made a conscious effort to have new people on. But of course, that means that a lot of people would like to see that face from 2 years ago, that person from last year. And, you know, it's a balance.
Right.
So, but yeah, I'm really glad that that if this does help people to get in touch with each other, I think that's terrific.
It absolutely does. I mean, it has for me throughout the years. So I appreciate what you do. So we'll have our conference February 9th. And then before that, I'm going to have some X spaces just detailing specifically what our intentions are with the next property, because people have expressed interest in buying in over the past couple months, but we've been sold out. You know, we only have the one property and all the lots are spoken for. So now as this next property becomes available, there will be public spaces just discussing what we intend on doing, what the lot sizes will be, what the costs will be. And so you got to factor in the cost of the acreage and then also infrastructure development like roads. And then some of that might be rolled together. Like we have an idea and we're not sure about this, but we might want to do an RV park, several people, not to have full-time RV residents, but we've had many, families come down with RVs and we don't have accommodations for them. And it would be a great way of transitioning into the lifestyle down here and starting your homestead to have water and septic and electric immediately and a concrete pad or something to set your RV on. Like that would be, it would make it much easier for people to come down here. So something like that, we would factor in those costs of septic, et cetera, and then the size of that lot. And so we want numbers to put forward and different lot sizes and just what is available with this next purchase. And also like, we'll probably discuss other potential ways of going about collective land buys, hear from other people who are doing similar things. So yep, those are the next land buy and the conference, the next big things. Also personally, I'm visiting South Africa soon to go see Irania. I feel like I have to go there, you know, given the nature of my project and what we're trying to do. We've already emulated them in many ways. So,
well, that sounds great. I mean, I would emphasize that basically the more people you're in contact with, the stronger your position, at least potentially, because there are all these people you are aware of that their abilities and they're aware of you. You have some sort of connection, some sort of rapport. And so you can call upon them in the future if need be. Whereas by contrast, the fewer people you know, it's like trying to run on empty. Most things happen apart from the individual will of one person. Most things happen because of connections and networking and what's the term? Collaboration to at least some degree, even if it's just someone else promoting what you're doing. That's a form of collaboration in the sense that you need to be aware of each other before you can do that. So I would say that this is why you should try to fall out with people as rarely as possible, which is sounds like such an obvious lesson. And yet there are so many people who don't ever learn it. It's amazing to me. I think you and I are sort of stalwart veterans enough that we have seen this happen time and again in the movement. And it certainly exasperated me, and I think probably you as well.
Yeah, you'd think it'd be a simple lesson. I myself am guilty of it on a couple occasions. I have called people out thinking they were feds. In one case, you know, Kurt Doolittle, I still think he was a federal contractor, so I was technically correct. But I also believe now, after all this time, that he's a good faith actor. And generally, I find that people that you're suspicious about up front, most of us actually believe in what we're saying and care about our greater good. So you do have to give people the benefit of the doubt. I'll also issue an apology to Imperium Press, because at one point I did call him, the guy who runs it, Mike, a fed. So like I'm guilty of it myself, not for several years now. I try to not stir up drama, but yeah, it's something we have to get better at.
Yeah. I think we've all made mistakes, and you can only learn and get better. All right. So to speak more broadly about intent, because the big picture of intentional communities as a solution, and obviously you'd bring Arania into that as well. Do you want to speak briefly about the direction in which you see America going in general over the next, in the future from here on? Or is that too broad a question? Maybe you have to break it down into states. I don't know. Would you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually bullish on the prospects for the American state. I think you're more pessimistic and you think, you know, we're headed towards civil war collapse and that sort of scenario. I don't think Americans have the willpower to actually put their lives at risk for that sort of thing. Even people on our side, where we're diehard ideologues, as close as it gets to it in the modern world. And most of us will remain anonymous in perpetuity and will not take any personal risks for the sake of our cause. So I don't think there is revolution fomenting. I don't think civil war type tensions are just part of the situation or calculation. I also don't think that there's any geostrategic rival that can actually challenge us. I think that, you know, Trump and Musk are pushing this, you know, increased high IQ, high skilled immigration. And as much as I don't want to see that for the sake of my country as a whole, it will keep us competitive. And, you know, America can offer better wages than China or India in most cases. So we're going to get all their smartest people. And you see just how workable these sorts of multiracial empires actually can be. Like all the great empires from antiquity, they were multiracial. And yeah, there was like a ruling ethnicity at the top. That's also no exception today. There's a ruling ethnicity in our society. And that's an ethnicity where they understand the value of making people not trust their neighbors. You know, like the ancient Assyrians, we read it about it in the Bible, where they displaced the elites from Israel and moved them to different parts of the empire so that they couldn't organize revolts, so that people in the local area wouldn't have nationalist sentiments where they're constantly afraid of their neighbors. If you mix all these people together, who does that really help? It helps the top-down administrative state. Because then you have to trust the state. You have to trust the police because you can't trust your neighbor. So it's actually a pretty workable situation for the purposes of power and also productivity. Because, I mean, there's a lot of land out there with our country, especially, where we can have productive, you know, economic powerhouse regions. And then we can have areas that are totally destitute with marauding, you know, thugs. And you can have both. There's room for both in this country. And that is what you see. You see this kind of economic segregation. And I think, you know, our economic fundamentals are more powerful than China's. We have demographic issues, but also we are a dynamic society. The innovation still typically happens here. We have the highest IQ people, the smartest people from around the world still very often want to come to America. They don't want to go to China. They don't want to live under the Chinese system, you know? So that kind of multiracialism can actually make American empire stronger. It's not what I personally want, but that's why I'm taking my intentional community approach. You know, if I can secure the right for white people to freely associate in intentional communities, and we can scale that such that there are millions of white Americans in these communities, that's as good as having a homeland to me. You know, no, but it's just because we have these different groups and a lot of disagreement doesn't mean we can't be a stable world power. Like Brazil, it's not a first world country exactly, but it's pretty functional considering how mixed and, you know, how bad the favelas are. Well, there's still a lot of wealthy, industrious people in Brazil. Or like South Africa, you'd think when whites are at 10% of the population, and farmers are being hunted down, that like they would all get it, but they don't. You know, the high IQ, high income whites in the Cape are still running their media companies. They're still they're sticking around for it because they have their private security. It's workable. So that's how far you can actually, I mean, South Africa can teach us a lot of lessons. One of the lessons is that it's modern states are much more resilient than we'd like to believe sometimes.
Yeah, you can have the shit lib enjoying a drink at Starbucks while all around her are marauding gangs, and she's quite unaware because, or at least she can kid herself about it because she's got private security or whatever. I mean, it's so strange and artificial a situation that you struggle to believe it's real. But I guess that will be the future for a lot of people.
So yeah, you'll become like Brazil, and that's what you see in Brazil as well. So yeah. I think these sorts of communities will just become necessary before too long in basically every European country. Maybe there are some countries in Europe that actually as a whole can go in a nationalist direction. I pray that that is the case, but I'm also very cynical about those in power, and I don't underestimate them. So I'm not super optimistic for that.
All right. So with that in mind, the purpose of intentional communities is to, well, to put it very starkly, is to preserve the white race.
Yeah, of course. And our way of life, our culture, like I don't just value European people. I wasn't a racist first. I still don't really consider myself. I'm like the least racist person here on the land, frankly. But yeah, it's like, I wasn't a racist first. I cared about Western philosophy. I went to school for classical music. I play the French horn. I play classical piano. I like, you know, Chopin and Brahms and Schopenhauer and Plato. And like, I realized at a certain point early on, doing my YouTube videos on philosophy that, everybody that I'm reading and sympathizing with and enjoying is European. Like every single thinker that I end up respecting and being drawn to, including like the people that I was watching on YouTube. It occurred to me that the people that I really identified with, the people that I got a lot out of in social media, on YouTube especially, they all had my same background and were part of a living tradition that we can't lose, you know, and we've already gotten very close to losing some major parts of it. Like people are culturally illiterate today. People don't read the great books. They read what they're assigned in high school, and really they don't read it. And nowadays I'm sure they're not reading it at all because they have AI to write their essays for them. You know, what are young white people doing in our institutions? Are they being inculcated into the Western tradition, or are they learning how to negotiate this kind of dystopic, like technocratic bureaucracy? And I think that's much more what they are actually learning how to do. They're not, the purpose of education really isn't to teach you skills to do well. Like the liberal ideal, liberal education is to become a part of a living cultural entity that it requires orientation. You know, you have to be introduced to the canon. You have to be taught how to think with the great thinkers of our past. And so I think they must go hand in hand. It's not just preserving our people. Yes, the culture has flowed from the biological characteristics of our people, sure, but strip that away and really, what are we? Like, we are a combination of our innate biological characteristics and also this larger epigenetic mesh of environment that allows our genetics to manifest to their fullest potential. You know, we're a complex system, our culture and also our biological makeup. So we got to preserve white people so that we preserve our white culture, so that white people can flourish and become virtuous again. And really, that's like, above all, like, as a Christian, I do care about individual salvation to a high degree. I think that has to sort of be the first thing that you confront. You can't immediately go to solve the problems of your race if you as an individual don't want to actually overcome your vice. I don't live up to it as well as I personally would like. And I know that, you know, having institutions, having communities where people are accountable, where they can be held accountable for their shortcomings, that gives people kind of the kick in the rear that they sometimes need to, you know, come to know themselves more fully. So we need the culture for that reason, to make us better, make us more competitive too. And also I think that the things that our people have produced throughout the ages are eternally of value. Even if we went extinct, it would still be important that, like, Plato's dialogues were preserved. It would still be important that we had the score of Brahms' First Symphony.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree. So with, I don't mean to discount that. I just want to, it's, I don't even know what to say. It's like, of course, I mean, we, what we have produced and what the best of us have produced must be preserved. And that is regardless of even if we survive. You know, you picked your examples. I would have others. I would say Hamlet, for example. You know, imagine a future where there is no copy of Hamlet. It's as if that never happened. That would be an immense loss. In fact, I would even say that I think preserving Hamlet, I'd be prepared to sacrifice quite a lot of human lives. You know, if it was the yeah. scales are, it's it makes me feel guilty. But you know, these things are, as you said, eternally valuable. So to move forwards, then, would you like to compare with or bring Urania into this and talk about how that is relevant to what you're doing?
Yeah, well, with Urania too, you know, both for legal reasons and I think because they actually believe in it, it's not just a white town in South Africa, it's an Afrikaner town, and you have to practice their culture, you have to speak their language, you have to know their history, and their schools teach their history and their traditions, and they have their folk dances, and they have their festivals. You need all of that. So I think no one is doing it better than Urania. There's also a lot more going on in South Africa, and I'm looking forward to networking with people both in Urania and also just in the broader Volkstadter movement. There are towns outside of just Urania that are trying to preserve their white majority through other means. You know, I think all of us respect what they're doing, but there are, you know, legal thinkers, philosophers, political philosophers out of South Africa that we should be paying more attention to. I've just recently become aware of some of them, and I can't pronounce their names, nor do I really recall. So I'm, you know, advocating something I'm not really practicing myself quite yet, but I do want to know more about their values. One thing that we've emulated from them that I think is extremely important is their principle of own work. So they never hire outside contractors, except where it's absolutely unavoidable. You know, you need heavy equipment that you just cannot feasibly provide yourself. And so we've copied that policy here. In many cases, our construction work would be simpler, easier, cheaper if we could just bring an outside crew in. But because we're using our own work, we are forced to, like, if we don't have the work ethic, if we're not willing to do it, things don't get done. And people see that, you know, and so that's that accountability aspect. It's also, I think, and this is benefiting Urania too, it subsidizes your own development. So instead of when you build a road, paying that money out to the general economy, which is filled with people who don't believe in our people and who don't believe in us, instead you're paying your own guys, who then in turn will have that money to use to develop their own lot. In our context, where we're all mutual owners of one legal entity, yeah, we have our own private lots and they're individually sellable, so you can sell individual lots under our framework. Like, if you build something, you can have that as the asking price. You do have to sell within the PMA. But in any case, a consequence of that doing our own work policy is that we are keeping the wealth in the community. So when we pay our own laborers, they then in turn have the money to pay to have their own lot developed, to have, you know, just more value as a whole for the whole project. So I think they're doing that very well. I see the imagery from the festivals. You know, I'm not an expert on Afrikaner culture. I'm not an expert on their political, philosophical thought. But I think there is something, the core notion is that it's about an ethno-cultural identity more than just a racial category. Because of their constitution, they can't just have racial discrimination, but they do have the right to cultural autonomy. And I think the racial aspect is unique, you know, in the United States, where we had a racial self-concept. We were white Americans. And for a while, that was the only kind of real American you could be. You know, that's what it was to be an American, or to be eligible to become an American citizen. Later on that expanded, but we have to like really reflect on, and this is something that the left will deconstruct, like what is the category of white people? Is that a natural category at all? Is it, it seems like there's a continuum and, you know, these things evolve and change. It's like, yeah, it does evolve and change to an extent. I believe in natural kinds. I think there is an archetypal white man out there in Plato's realm of forms somewhere. But no, I think that we have to see how it's evolved and changed and own our own, what cultural, ethnocultural thing are we actually a part of? There's a series of talks on John Vervaeke's YouTube channel where he goes into this. I forget the guest's name. It was some black philosopher, I guess, but he was talking about the black ethnocultural identity. And that's why the Associated Press standards now have like capitalized black B, because it's not a race. It's not a racial category. They classify black as an ethnocultural entity. So it's what the Afrikaners are doing in Orania and the Volkstadter movement and their political philosophy. It's also what the left is doing in like saying, oh, it's not just a racial category. It's not, because the race is a social construct. What matters though is this living tradition that these people are a part of. And even the left in America recognizes that has legitimacy. So we can learn from this. And when we as white Americans are formulating, like, what are we about? What are we a part of? Well, we're not just white in the lowercase sense, which, okay, fine. We can say lowercase white when it's just the racial category, but it's more than just a racial category. It's an ethnocultural identity where there's a racial self-concept. And so the white uppercase is a racial self-concept in the American ethnocultural identity, and we can own that and be a part of that. And to do that well, you got to know your history, and you got to really say like who you belong to. So it's thinking about what South Africa has done, Iranius in particular, thinking about how other minority groups in America have negotiated this problem of identity. It's given me you know, a fresh perspective on what exactly it means to be a white American. And I'm much more comfortable now than I was like 8 years ago when we last spoke, just owning it and saying, yeah, white American is its own ethnocultural thing. Even if not all of us are exactly the same genetically, we're part of one common story, one common self-concept. There is a racial element, but that's part of our culture. The racial element is there because it's part of our culture. And because we value our culture, we value that race. We can care about race independently, but it's these are some of the ideas that I'm developing from that inspiration.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is a sort of push and pull here, and it happens elsewhere as well. I remember the Irish a few years ago, the people in our movement who are living in Ireland, who are Irish, they always resented, I noted it specifically with them, although I've seen it elsewhere as well, they always resented being called white. And they would say, I'm not white, I'm Irish. And of course, then you've got this rather tedious thing of saying, yes, of course I know you're Irish, but you must know you're white as well, surely. But they're not denying that they're white. They're saying they don't really care about that. They care about being Irish, even if being white is part of being Irish. So they would reject the idea of a black Irishman or you know, a Chinese Irishman or whatever. And yet they would say they don't really care about, they don't identify as white. They identify as Irish. So I think I can understand this. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've come to understand it and sympathize with it. And it's not that I don't care about the white race. I do. I've got friends of all different nationalities. Literally my best friends are of different nationalities than British. So I clearly do identify, like I have a common feeling with them, and I care about them very much. And yet I am not simply white. I am a slightly eccentric amalgam of British with a bit of Italian, but basically British, half Scottish. That's fine. I'm quite, you know, there's no sort of, as far as I know, I'm very comfortable in this identity. I don't really feel that there's any, you know, any hang-ups or anything like that. But I understand that I am not just white, and the Irish person is not just white either. There is something specific, and that it's that specificity which inspires and galvanizes. Whereas to say that you're simply white is kind of dull, even if it mm-hmm. shouldn't be. Even if it shouldn't be, because you can think of Europe as a totality, and it's pretty exciting and an admirable thing, and an admirable race, an admirable type of a human being. Yeah, it should be inspiring, and yet I think when the rubber hits the road, people need something more local. So the German will not merely see himself as white, or European even. He'll see himself as a German, which has all sorts of connotations and things attached to it. And of course, this also applies in America. It might even, for all I know, apply to the individual state. I think there, as my Stephen, a frequent commenter, often says this, that he is an Appalachian, and that's his thing. And of course, Texans always have a very stubborn sense of being Texan, not merely American, but something more specific. And so I think with Americans, of course, they are white Americans. You might shorten that to white. I think most people do. But what it is actually referring to is the specific identity of a white American. And as I say, sometimes more specific even than that, down to the Nebraskan, the Iowan, right, and so forth. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So like David Hackett Fisher's famous book, Albion Seed, talks about the different English groups that came over to found America. So the Puritans came first, and the Cavaliers from Southwest England were mainly, you know, mainline Anglicans, and then the Quakers who came from the north of England, and then the Scots-Irish who came from the Irish Sea region. And they didn't like each other at all. You know, they didn't want to form one country with all of these, even though they were all English, they had different religious convictions, different cultural norms. You know, a lot of what people see in the American redneck, even like living in log cabins or just kind of the, not the brick, you know, impressive facades that you see in Puritan New England, but like, why did rednecks in the South develop in that way? Because that was the way that it was done in South, or like, I guess, Western England, in the borderlands between Scotland and England, where Macbeth is set, you know, because there were constant raids for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you couldn't have something nice. They would just come and smash it and steal it. So like the American redneck is what they are because of this really deep, you know, like heritage that's more than even just English. It goes more specific than that, even within England. And I think that we can lean into that. You know, I tend to be on the side that like I would rather have had the Articles of Confederation that gave more rights to individual states than the Constitution, which I think has inevitably led to this one top-down system. I mean, I'll work with it because somebody has to be the world hegemon. The American system has become the most powerful. As an American, it's hard to totally begrudge that. It's like, all right, we're the most powerful. That's kind of cool. Maybe we can work with it. And as long as, you know, we can secure our legal rights to have our own communities, we can have the goods that were originally there in that Articles of Confederation, America 1.0 conception, what was there in the colonial period, where you had different autonomous entities. Yeah, they were all under the crown, but they were really self-governing. They were really self-determining. They were producing their own culture. So with intentional communities, the direction I would like to see it take is formalizing what we were already doing with the inception of the country, where there are two levels of identity. There is the white identity, which it's not just a racial thing. That's lowercase w, white. We were white with a capital W, where this is the self-conception of a higher European man. And it wasn't exactly the same even back then as like European, as in you're from this continent. No, it was a type of man, an enlightened type of man. That's what being white really meant. And we can embrace that kind of higher self-concept and see that it is rooted in our history. It's not just a biological category that you check or don't check. And then underneath that, we can all have allegiance to that. And we can recognize also that there is a collective struggle for the continued existence of the white identity. And we can see that that's pressing. And we can see that all white people have an obligation to help each other for our posterity. But then under that, you know, we have the PMA, which is like the equivalent of that, like we are white people of good character. And then under that, particular LLCs can set their own standards. We can have particular communities of particular denominations of Christianity, or particular sects of paganism, or particular European ethnicities, or new things. You know, like when we came to America to start all of these colonies, there was a lot of novelty. There was like the Quakers, you know, they were just getting started in England when then they came over here and established a new way of life that had never been before. And America has this tradition of utopian intentional communities. That's part of our founding. Like America was itself founded by utopian intentional communities. So I want to encourage that. Like if we have a vision for how our particular form of white existence can look, we should be given the tools to actually manifest that. You know, that's part of just being like fulfilling your potential is creating what it's possible for you to create. I think many of us, you know, 8-10 years ago when you and I were both on YouTube, I remember listening to different thinkers like Ryan Falk back then, who would talk about very abstract political philosophy, and you know, he would advocate anarchism or advocate tribal communism. And I was thinking, like, what is really the point of this? Because we're never going to change America to fall in line with it. But there was a point to it, and we have these instincts to philosophize politically and think about different ways society could be, because hey, this is actually possible for us. Like if we realize that we don't have to wait for the government to do all of this for us, the government that hates us, like the world is really wide open, like especially in America. I wish it was the same in Europe, but we also, like I said, accept some European members of the PMA. So maybe you can come here and participate in what we're doing as well. And then we can, you know, recolonize the motherland once you guys are totally fallen. But no, I think Europe has a bright future. America has a bright future. I would like to see, though, America's imperial role be a source of security for white communities all around the world. Just like, you know, Israel backs the existence of its Jewish diaspora, I want to see the United States, which admittedly it will be a multicultural empire in the not too distant future. It already effectively is that, but I would like to see it secure the existence of these sorts of intentional white communities and just intentional communities more broadly. Like we can coexist and have groups that are, you know, Black nationalist communities. Louis Farrakhan has a community like that, I think, and has advocated that for years. But like if the top-down imperial structure allows for it, that's the critical issue, which is why we have to be so careful how we go about establishing these tiered layers of identity, what we're investing our time into, what the legal conception is, and how then that meets at the top with the state ultimately, and we have sanction from the state. And I think none of this is totally antithetical to liberal priors, even. It's like, it's in line with the spirit of liberalism. It's in line with the spirit of the founding. It's not the kind of reactionary political conception that many of us have been used to. It's kind of national socialist perspective, which is by far, I think, the most popular in our circles. And if that were an option, I'd be all for it. But if it's not an option, we do have to think about other possibilities.
All right. Fascinating. Very interesting stuff. Okay. I won't pick up on any of that because I think I've given my perspective and you've given yours, and I think there's not much disagreement at all, to be honest. All right. So you also wanted to talk about the education and the prep school that you're starting and your own online philosophy groups. Is that completely separate from the community, or is it integrated with that?
It is integrated. So when I agreed to do this, I was reluctant to actually move down and join the community. Ironically, I've advocated for it for years, but I had kind of consigned myself to the fact like no one seems to be supporting this kind of project, so I'll just do my own school. So that's what I was focused on. And I had finally, after years of saving and scraping, gotten my 13 acres, and I had a space to do it. And then just as I, you know, was ready to launch almost, then, you know, they wanted me to come down here and start from scratch again. But I did, on the condition that I could run my school here out of the community. So when the community center is finished, I will be allowed to run my classes out of that facility. And also, I think it's just a good thing to have a school of the type that I'm envisioning embedded in a community where there are work opportunities, where there are just elders in general for younger guys to learn from. I think we need like initiatic groups like the way that the Mannerbund functioned throughout Indo-European societies from the very beginning. And, you know, Patriot Front is doing that. It's providing that for a lot of guys. Active Clubs is providing that for a lot of guys. But I think we need a formal institution, particularly for those who are attracted to intellectual pursuits. And in terms of curriculum and the specifics, I am just a hardcore traditionalist. I think we use the ancient curriculum. So I use the curriculum that Iamblichus came up with in the fourth century. So it's a certain set of Platonic dialogues with the Neoplatonic commentary. And I've already gone through the sequence once in previous reading groups. I'm now relaunching it on a new website, Thinkific, because it's organized in, you know, different lessons. So everything is accessible. Even after the course is done, you can purchase the course and go through everything at your own pace. In the past, I've just had reading groups and we all read together. And I think there's value in that. That's the online component. I would basically like to turn that into an in-person institution. And I think that there's an opportunity if we make it a norm in our circles that when you turn 18, when you graduate high school, you don't immediately go into college. Many of us should go to college and get credentials to be significant members of the broader society because we need that representation. You know, Nick Fuentes has advocated that approach for years, and there is truth to it. But without specific instructions on how to become an elite, you're kind of just banking on, well, we have all the high IQ guys. And yeah, we have high IQ guys, very, you know, high quality people, but so just frankly, like so do the Jews, so do the Koreans, so do the Indians. There are a billion Indian people. And yeah, like maybe our IQ is higher on average, but the average IQ of a Brahmin in India is 112. You know, that's higher than our, and there's probably more Brahmin than there are white Americans. I don't know the numbers on that for sure. But in any case, just banking on we have the best guys, they're going to rise to the top. It's not too secure, especially when Trump and Musk want to bring in millions of high-skilled workers from around the world. And also, our system is still anti-white. We still have DEI. We still have affirmative action. So we need a way to differentiate ourselves apart from just we're really high caliber, high quality people. We need an institution to convert those high potential young people into something more than what we see today. And I think that the way to do that is classical education. I think the English boarding school was the peak example of this being done in our history. And today I'm sure it's a totally bastardized institution compared to what it was just decades ago. But we can learn, and they were based on a kind of classical model. You know, you learned Greek, you learned Aristotle, you learned, you read Homer, you know, you did this stuff. So we need that kind of curriculum. I have my own, you know, I'm a Platonist. That's where my like philosophical allegiances lie. So of course I'm going to take a highly Platonist angle on classical education, but also to be fair, that is just in the classical world, Platonism was dominant. And by the end of antiquity, it was basically like, what type of Platonist were you? It wasn't, you know, which school did you fall under? The Peripatetics died out. The Stoics died out. Everybody at the end, who was anybody, was a Neoplatonist, and they had all the serious institutions. That's what got taken up into the medieval period. That's the origins of scholasticism, were those late Neoplatonic academies. And I think we need to recover that history, understand that history to know ourselves, but also they knew what they were doing in designing their courses, in explicating their philosophical concepts, in teaching logic. I think we simply do what, because I can't do better than them. I'm sure that I can't. You know, so that's the goal, to have a kind of, you know, boarding school like atmosphere eventually for specifically like 18 to 22 year olds as a kind of pre-college, post-high school program. That's my long-term ambition. That's what I would like to see. But there's a lot of work to do before we get there.
Yeah, there's a lot there. One thing I would say is, from my own experience, I think that 18 was a bad age to start studying. I think I needed some mm-hmm. time to out in the world, as it were. I think there was too much sort of energy that I think is probably quite natural and common in men, boys of that age, is to sort of mm-hmm. drive you out into the world. I didn't want to study at all, but not
yeah. And there are work later on. Like, there's a lot of physical
a bit, but yeah. Sorry, go on.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, there's a lot of physical work here too, that like young guys want to learn these skills. Young guys want to be around, you know, older, wiser, more accomplished people to absorb their wisdom. And it shouldn't just all be college professors. It should be our guys. So we need to throw them into not the wider world, which I don't want for 18-year-olds. I think that's a terrible idea. Like, there's so many sources of corruption. But if we have our own communities where they can actually be nurtured, then whether they stay in the community network or eventually go into the wider world, you know, they have that opportunity to just explore themselves before they, you know, get into the kind of drudgery of their technical field and, you know, getting into all that coursework.
Yeah, yeah. And get corrupted by university. At least if they've got this grounding that you're talking about, then they can resist the corruption to some extent, maybe a great extent. So I agree also about preserving this tradition, because I don't know at this point if there are any universities. You asked about British boarding schools. I don't know, but I certainly find it hard to imagine that they're as rigorous as they were 100 years ago or 150 years ago. Seems extremely unlikely. Now, as for universities, we all know how the humanities departments have been degraded and perverted over the last 70 or 80 years, maybe longer. So at this point, I don't know if there is any place where you could get a truly classical education. It sounds an incredible thing to say. Maybe there is a place somewhere, but I think it would cost an absolute fortune.
There was a project, I think, out of London that unfortunately may have been aborted. It was associated with Prometheus Trust. They were a publisher primarily of Platonic and Aristotelian texts. I have a lot of Prometheus Trust editions of different books, but they wanted to open like a specifically Platonic academy in London, but now I can't find anything about it. So I'm unaware of any institution like that, which seems like, okay, if we care about like European identity, the Western tradition, how is it that we have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people now that are, you know, quote unquote red-pilled, but we haven't put together at least one just classical model education school. It's really, you know, it's really shocking to me. So I think that's a very important goal that we should all have, not just a school, but also we should have our own orchestras. We should have our own artist co-ops. We need to be creating culture, and we need those physical institutions where people can come learn the skills. And also, once they've gained those skills, collaborate with other experts. And yeah, I mean, our enemies, so to speak, have that. You know, they have that in spades. That's why they're powerful. We can't. Yeah.
When I said earlier about people being Irish rather than white and so forth, I did mean to include that aspect of culture into that. It's about the traditions that you absorb, and the of course the geography that you are amongst. All of that is true as well. You just reminded me of it there. But yes, I think this is a very worthy goal indeed, about setting up an institution to preserve that tradition. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God knows if we leave it to the mainstream, it is probably not got much of a future, if it even has a present. As I say, I'm not sure that it even does just now. Okay, well, we'll get to the super chats now, unless there's anything else that you'd want to say about that before we do that.
Well, one of our members was a classics teacher, specifically focused in history, at a private school, and he lost his job for speaking the truth about that history, his subject, for just like covering the texts that he wanted to cover. I don't think it does exist today, and it's very sad. So
that's shocking. Somebody has mentioned Logos School or New St. Andrew's College in North Idaho, possibly.
Yeah, that's David. I forget the guy's name. He's a Protestant Christian. Interesting guy. Definitely not a based school. It's a classics school, but it's not racially aware or rooted in European identity.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, here is Stephen says, if not speaking German is worth millions of lives, then Hamlet must be worth a planet or two. Very good, Stephen. He also says, some of my best friends are German. Yes, we hillbillies are proud. Long line of English and Scots. This is the guy who's Appalachian. Line of English and Scots Ulsters, which have kind of morphed into what you always hear me call Anglo-Celtic. Besides, what even is white? Joking. Thank you, Stephen. Very good. All right. Alt White said, happy holidays all. Happy holidays to you. Thank you for that. Shambolics said, bravo to Arvol and Woodlander on their community initiatives. Some unsolicited advice. Study Rhodesia and its takedown. It's bleak but necessary to do this. For fun, check out the wacky documentary series Wild Wild Country. They employed some interesting legal tactics to build their community. That's Wild Wild Country, something you might want to look into.
Appreciate Alt-White, that.
Yeah. Alt-White also said, I respect your religious conviction, but Christians are not the target of genocide. We white Europeans are the target of genocide, and we need to unite as a racial community with all other considerations aside. Well, it sounds like that's what Arvol is doing by having pagans in this community as well. But Arvol, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I do think that primarily Christian identity can be a source of division in our movement, and that question needs to be worked out. I'm on the fringe of the Christian side. I'm basically in the middle, where I'm primarily a Platonist. You know, I'm like Origen in terms of my Christian philosophy. I'm essentially a, you know, pagan Neoplatonist with a few added elements from Christianity. I believe in the figure of Jesus and his moral teachings. I think they were genuine. I think no one realistically lives in a way where they don't acknowledge those teachings, and people don't understand how historically novel they were. Just the idea of like forgiveness, that like we had clans fighting it out even in recent times under Christianity, like Ireland was killing itself for thousands of years before they became Christian, where you have to be willing to forgive especially like your people, if you want to be forgiven, that idea of reciprocal forgiveness, that's the teaching that I take to heart, the idea that anyone can be saved. Like maybe their life can't be redeemed, like maybe they have to be executed, but the idea that like salvation is possible for all of us, I think there is a fundamental kind of metaphysical equality that Christianity teaches that most good people will acknowledge. That doesn't mean that there isn't a real hierarchy in a bunch of other respects, but anywho, like I believe in that core teaching, but metaphysically, I think that these two systems, like European paganism and Christianity, are not talking about different things. Because I don't think Jesus was preaching the covenant of Yahweh. I don't think that, I mean, I think he was against it. I'm on the semi-Marcionite side of things. I think that Jesus was essentially a Platonist, and like his values stem from that genuine, true kind of metaphysical theological system that Europeans had across the board throughout our Christian past with scholasticism and classical theism, in the ancient past with pagan Neoplatonism. And I think that they can be reconciled. I think if we really study the history and realize we're a part of this one living tradition that was both pagan and Christian, like the early Christians would not have been what they were without Plato. And the Neoplatonists wouldn't have been what they were without the Christians. There was a dialectic between these traditions and was until recent times. And there's still this dialectic, and that's all part of who we are. So I totally agree. But I think there's a ranked hierarchy of how to appropriately arrange these things. And so that's, I call myself a Christian, but I think the entire European tradition can be harmoniously, you know, reconciled.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to fall out about these things unless we choose to, unless we want to. Otherwise, I think reasonable people can get along, frankly. It sounds like a rather trite and hippie-ish, but I just think this ultimately is a decision that we make to take something so personally or seriously that it ends up pitting us against our fellows. Okay. The Woodlander said, "Return to the land is a shining example of what is possible when Europeans collectivize. Congratulations. It is the way forward." Well, thank you,
right.
Woodlander.
Salute to him. Yeah, he's doing excellent work. I have been meaning to message him to invite him to the conference as well. I'd love to have the Woodlander speak at the Intentional Community Conference. So.
Oh, well, I mean, I can put you in touch if you're not already in touch. Okay, and then finally, Pure White said, "Young men like Arvol and Russo give me hope for the future of America and white well-being. Happy Yule, gents." There we go. Well, thank you very much for that super chat. All right. Is there anything else that you would like to say before we finish?
No, we covered a lot here.
Yeah, we did.
Again, I appreciate what you've done keeping this going all these years, and I do hope that you keep it up in the future. You know, I always learn about new people through Millennial, and I'm honored to be on, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. All right. Well, I will be back soon with a representative from the Company of Adventurers in Canada. But in the meantime, Arvol, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial X.
All right. Thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy Yule.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.